morning. I trust you're all well. We are fortunate today to have Steve Fuller from the University of Warwick speaking to us today. You read two interviews with Steve from the Breakthrough Institute. This is The Rise of Upbringers, Part 1 and Part 2. Professor Fuller is...
It's being recorded, Jim. Be careful.
is the Auguste Comte Chair at the University of Warwick. That's a very fancy kind of title. He is a fancy scholar, having published apparently 23 books, hundreds of articles. He is all over your internet, YouTube form. In fact, I'm going to play a brief YouTube video to introduce him, so I'm going to go kind of straight to meta today and have him introduce himself through video. This video is with regard to the most recent book that he's published called The Academic Caesar. University administration is hard.
University leadership is hard.
It is, and so I was thinking of Will Ferrell as George Bush, President of the United States, to be president.
Yeah, it's hard.
On Wednesday, I will distribute exam 3, which is essentially your final exam for the class. We will go over it in the same fashion we have exam 1 and exam 2. Before we begin, are there any questions, concerns?
Regrets?
Regrets, I've had a few. Okay, so I'm going to play this video. It lasts about 2.5 minutes, and I think it's kind of an interesting introduction to the discussion today.
And the first piece of advice has to do with how to deal with academics, and the second piece of advice has to do with how to deal with students. In the case of how to deal with academics, I think the academic needs to keep in mind that
is it possible to get up the word file now, or do you have to wait till this is over?
They are, in a sense, very much concerned about what it is to promote their own lines of research, their own modes of teaching, that they have become very familiar and accustomed to over the years. Nevertheless, the academic Caesar has to be championing the university as a forward-looking, futuristic institution that may have to challenge some of these notions that the academics hold very near and dear in terms of the way they work and the kinds of work that they do. On the other hand, with regard to students, I do not think that a student should go to a university under the expectation that the customer is always right, that the point of going to a university is actually to be challenged, and that this should be the reason, this should be the thing that the student knows that he or she is signing up to when they go to a university. So in other words, what they are being challenged to do is they're being challenged to think about what it is to have an autonomous, self-responsible form of life, regardless of what career or what job one enters into. So it's a training for life. It's a training of the whole person. This is what the university ought to be about, and students should be attracted to a university primarily on those grounds. Because we already know that in the kind of economic climate in which we live, it is very unlikely that any student going to a university today will retire from the same job in which he or she started. You will go through many different kinds of positions, maybe even be unemployed, but nevertheless, you will still be the same person. And what is that person, and what does it mean to think for oneself in society? And this is something that the university is unique in being able to provide the kind of training for.
I'm sorry if this looks like a commercial. I didn't realize this was going to happen. It is designed to be a commercial, but I didn't realize it was going to be shown here. Well, first of all, let me thank Jim. And one thing that Jim didn't mention about me is that I was actually a professor here 25, 30 years ago. Okay, so I have been here before.
More videos from you.
Let's shut that down, please. We don't want to get them too confused. This is me in Dublin or something. I don't know, but never mind.
I just can't get rid of you.
I know. Get me back on in the normal way. Okay. All right, so I was a professor here 25, 30 years ago in the Science and Technology Studies program. What I want to talk to you about today, given the frame in which Jim has placed me in your course, is about the future of politics and what that looks like. And you've read some interviews that I've done with the Breakthrough Institute. I take it that you've sort of read these things. And the Breakthrough Institute is one of, you might say, a kind of environmental think tank that is very much high-tech in its orientation. In other words, the way we solve the problems of the environment is by actually being very progressive with regard to introducing new technologies that make our ability to produce energy and so forth more efficient, but at the same time also cleaner as well. I'm not going to talk anything more about that, but what I am going to talk about is this kind of configuration of the future of politics that I mentioned in the interview and has been very much part of my writing in recent years. And this has to do with, you might say, a sort of 180-degree shift in the axis in which we think about politics. So at the moment, the conventional way of thinking about politics is in terms of left versus right. Right? We have left wing, right wing. I think you're all familiar with what those terms are. And what I am arguing, basically, is that in the future, it will be up versus down. Right, so you imagine the rotation of the axis here. So in other words, aspects of the current left and right wing perspectives will be reorganized in this new way. So let me give you a sense of what I have in mind here to begin with. Okay, how many of you know about the origin of the left wing, right wing distinction? Any of you familiar with the history behind that? Okay, well, let me just say something a little bit about that then initially. Okay. The left-wing, right-wing distinction goes back to the French Revolution at the end of the 18th century, and it had to do with the way in which the National Assembly, which was basically the parliamentary congressional body that was established after the Revolution, how they arranged the people in the new parliament after the Revolution happened. So the king is overthrown, you probably know about that part of the French Revolution, but then how was the government arranged? And what you had basically was a kind of, in the middle, would be someone who represents the status quo. And the status quo would be what? The church, the monarchy perhaps, but then there would be a right wing and a left wing. And the right wing were the people who basically said that in a sense what we need to do is actually to go back and reinforce our traditions. So in other words, we need to have the church more involved, we need to respect authority, we need to do all that kind of thing. The left wing were actually very much for, and the left wing, by the way, what left wing meant was a combination of what we would now call liberals and socialists. In other words, they were for the idea that people should be, as it were, freed from whatever hereditary constraints there have been. I mean, one thing you need to understand is that before we get to the 19th century, the way you as a person was defined was primarily in terms of where you were born, who you were born to, right? It was hereditary, okay? So there was very little class mobility. There was very little opportunity for people to actually shift from one kind of form of life to another form of life in the course of their lifetime, because your legal status was actually determined by how you were born, where you were born, okay? And what you start to get in the beginning of the 19th century, and the French Revolution is very important in this regard, is the idea that you're going to loosen up these legal restrictions. So you're actually going to enable people to be able to kind of move forward in society on the basis of their own achievement. You're going to allow them to move from the farms to the towns. And so whereas in the farms, their parents, you know, your parents may have been people who were working for some kind of lord of the manor, right? When you move into the city, you now can kind of sell your labor freely, and depending on who's willing to hire you, you might actually be able to make a great success of yourself. And when we talk about liberalization and liberalism, this is primarily what we mean. Socialism is actually the view that in order for this liberalization to succeed, people actually have to work together to enable it to succeed. Otherwise, people will just be exploited. And this is Karl Marx, and that's that kind of socialism, okay?
But the point is, with the French Revolution, you get this kind of distinction very clearly made. Namely, the difference between people who say that we should go back and reinforce our past roots, and that something like the French Revolution was a bad thing, versus those who say, actually, we should open up things even more. Okay? So this was the left and right distinction as it was originally conceived. And of course, these ideas have developed over the course of the last 200 years. And the point that I would raise to you here is that within both the left and the right, there has always been a kind of internal contradiction. And I think for any of you who follow politics, this is pretty easy to see, actually. Okay? So let's look at the right for a moment. The right consists of two internally contradictory parts. One part are the family values, religion kind of people. On the other hand, it's the libertarians, the Donald Trumps of the world. Donald Trump got elected on the Republican Party. He is not the obvious spokesperson for family values, religion, or anything moral or ethical. Come on. Even those of you who voted for him know that. But it's interesting, right? Because the right wing has both of these things coexisting. And indeed, a lot of evangelical Christians, who are operating as hypocrites or not, voted for Trump. Right? So the right wing is a kind of internally divided thing. Right? It's got, on the one hand, these radical freedom mongers, which Trump obviously represents, right? But then they also got these very conservative, in the very classical sense of family value, religious people. And they're both on the same side. That's bonkers from a rational standpoint. But that's the way it goes. But equally, on the left, you have got a contradictory thing going on. And I think the way you see this in terms of the recent presidential campaign in the United States is the difference between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton supporters. Okay? Hillary Clinton, technocratic, big government, top down, experts rule everything. You know, you're gonna, you know, if you, social justice will be delivered from Washington, not from you. Right? That is the, that is the kind of one vision. It's a vision that becomes very apparent in American politics as a sign of the left, starting with Woodrow Wilson, when you start to get the idea of federal income tax, right? And the idea that the United States is thinking of itself as a big kind of large system, and the idea is to kind of manage that large system by pushing people around to do different things. And of course, Franklin Roosevelt with the New Deal, that's also part of that technocratic vision at all. As well, and Lyndon Johnson with the Great Society. Again, if you know something about American history and the history of progressive politics, the most powerful part of the left in American politics has been a top-down Washington-based politics. So in that respect, Hillary Clinton is very much part of the establishment that has been in existence in the United States for 100 years as being the driving force of progressive politics. She's exactly right when she claims the progressive mantle for herself. But that is only half of the left. The other half of the left is this kind of bottom-up, social justice, community-based activism that is very responsive to local issues, and this is where Bernie Sanders comes in. A general skepticism about big government, right? And a sense that people in some sense personally have to take back governance for themselves, right? And this is why, you know, I mean, I think the interesting thing about the way in which Sanders and Clinton operated during the primaries was how civil they were to each other. Because I think the sensibility with regard to where the left should go is radically different. Hillary Clinton, at the end of the day, is about having, you might say, economists run the world. That is kind of what it boils down to. You know, economists or expert social scientists or something like that. Whereas Bernie Sanders is about putting power in the hands of the people. But both of those things have been part of the left. There is no doubt about it. Both of them have been part of the left. And if you look at the kind of political unrest that took place in the 1960s in the United States, right, and I was a kid back then, that contradiction was really being played out. Okay? Because somebody like Lyndon Johnson, right, who's this president of the United States, top-down kind of guy, was actually enabling civil rights for black people to happen. Okay? But at the same time, there was all this grassroots kind of uprising against the fact that that very same government was putting Americans at peril in Vietnam War. okay? So the contradiction of the left was very much then present in the 1960s. So the point here is that we have got these two wings that have been part of the establishment of conventional politics in the Western world for the last 200 years, born of the French Revolution, right? They have internal contradictions, both of them. And I think with the US presidential election, this became incredibly obvious. It became incredibly obvious. So where do we go from here, okay? I think one of the things that is very clear with regard to young people's involvements in politics is that the traditional party-based configurations, so if you think about the Republican Party as being somehow the party in the United States that is trying to hold together both all of the, you know, the religious family value type people with the libertarian people somehow, right, in one group, and the Democratic Party somehow trying to hold together all the community activist Bernie Sanders type people with the kind of, you know, top-down technocratic people from Hillary Clinton's camp, trying to hold those together, you realize this is not something that's going to hold forever. And as a result, younger people are not identifying very strongly with political parties, right? Because those parties, as they are currently constituted, don't actually make that much sense. And it's not like you guys don't understand that. In fact, you probably see it more clearly than your elders do, because your elders are just taking for granted that there's a kind of internal coherence to the Republican Party that just needs to be worked out, or there's an internal coherence to the Democratic Party. There isn't. It is indeed both internally contradicted. Okay, so this is the thing, I think, in terms of where we are now. And so what do you see people identify with regard to politics? And this is where I say we shift from left-right to up-down, okay? Which means that parts of each wing, the left and the right, end up reconfiguring with the other. Okay, that's kind of what that's why I talk about it as a rotation of the axes, okay? Now, this idea of upwing versus downwing is actually a distinction. In a way, I've made a big deal about this distinction, but this distinction has actually been around for a while. It's just people haven't really paid much attention to it. But in the 1970s, it was actually invented, okay? And it was a futurist, and this is where the whole futurist thing comes in, a futurist who went by the name of FM 2030. That was his nickname. He was, in fact, a son of an Iranian diplomat. Remember, we're talking about the period of the Shah. I don't know how much you know about Iranian politics, but Iran, up to the time of 1979, right, when the Ayatollah Khomeini took over the country and Iran became this theocracy of Islam, right? Before that time, Iran was basically a kind of a client state of the United States. Very westernized place, very sophisticated place, okay? The Shah of Iran was that kind of a guy. And so this guy, FM 2030, is part of that crew. He was the son of one of the diplomats of that final period, you might say, in which Iran was seen as some kind of a beacon toward the West within the Middle East. Because Iran was it remains today, relatively wealthy, relatively well-educated, advanced kind of nation. The question is just where its alliances are. But the thing is that this guy comes from that kind of a background. And so his father was stationed for a while in Brussels with the European Union and then was stationed in Washington. And so this guy in the 1970s, FM 2030, the reason why he called himself 2030, FM is the first initials of his name, the 2030 had to do with how long he thought he was going to live. He was born in 1930, okay, 1930, and so he thought he'd live 100 years. He actually lived 70 years, and he died of cancer in a fairly traditional sort of way, actually. But he is the first one to have been put into the deep freeze, cryonics. Do you know about cryonics? Right?
Just to let you know how futuristic we can get around here, right? So this is the idea. How many of you know this term, cryonics? Put your hands up. Okay, a few of you do. Okay, so the idea here is immediately after you die, right, you basically get frozen, right, until the time at which somebody can figure out how to resurrect you. That's kind of the basic strategy here. And so there is this place in Arizona called Alcor,
which is the great mecca of cryonics. And I don't mean to use mecca lightly here. This is the place of worship. I mean, Alcor. Okay? That's where FM 2030 currently lies in state and rest, as it were, until one comes up with the kind of medical knowledge that would enable him to be resurrected. Okay? And this was something that he, and so he, you know, so he dies in the year 2000, and he kind of already planned that, you know, the future is part of what he wants to be involved in. And this is, in a way, gives you a sense of how people, this kind of move is beginning to give you a sense of how people are thinking about themselves, not simply in terms of relating to their immediate society or their families. And because if you think about the way in which the left and the right as political ideologies have been defined historically, right? You know, with the right, we think about things like your relationship to your family, to your background, to your religion, right? In the case of the left, you talk about the communities in which you normally live, or perhaps some kind of governmental structure. But here we're talking about a relationship to the future as being definitive of who you are. So in other words, this guy, FM 2030, did not believe his life was over when he died, but rather what he believed was that in some sense his life will be resurrected. He will come back. And he will be part of this new society. And that is part of his extended being. This is part of the new politics that we're talking about here, right? Where people are beginning to think of themselves not just in the more conventional ways we've imagined human interaction, whereby the people who are most relevant to us are the people who we physically interact with. We're in fact talking about a very extended sense of personhood. And of course, we already know this on an everyday basis through social media, right? There's a sense in which the idea of your being an extended person, the fact that the most important things about you, the things that you find most meaningful about yourselves, are the things that are, as it were, not necessarily stored in you as a physical being here, but rather stuff that is stored on the cloud, all sorts of distributed in lots of different places to which many different people can have access. Okay? So this is, in a way, becoming the new sphere of politics. Is opening up in a very curious kind of way. Because if you think about what the point of politics is supposed to be, namely to provide the good society or the just society for people, right, we've typically operated with a fairly kind of standardized notion of what a person is, right? So when we talk about, quote, all men are created equal, right, this kind of thing, right? When we talk in those terms, right, we usually have an idea that what we're talking about when we say a person is that we're talking about Homo sapiens, right, upright ape, right, people who kind of look like you, and that's kind of where your person is, right? And in a sense, politics is about managing the relationships between those beings, right, understanding various things about you guys, namely that you think different thoughts, but your physical requirements are roughly the same. Right? In other words, you take up about the same amount of space, you eat about the same amount of food, whatever, right? There's a sense in which the physicality defines the kind of person who you are. And all of politics, in a sense, up to this point, has been about managing that relationship among people who are regarded as rough equals. And let me tell you something, liberalism would never have got off the ground if people did not believe this very deeply. Because liberalism is really about taking everyone as being potentially equal to operate in the same way. And what is the basis for thinking that in the first place? It's the rough physical equality of people. That is to say, you may be stronger at certain things than I am, but I'm stronger than you in other things. And it's going to be that kind of rough equality over a wide range of qualities that actually defines, why we have to think about ourselves as working together in some kind of common society. That is very much part of the modern political situation. The social contract, again, I don't know how much you know about the history of political theory, but that is what politics is based on in the modern period. Rough physical equality of human beings. But now we live in a world where people are not even primarily identifying themselves with their physical bodies. Right? Where your primary sense of identity is coming from some sort of distributed stream of stuff that is floating through many different channels, through social media, whatever. And again, this is a very, I'll give you a good example. Let me give you a good example if you don't quite get what I'm saying. I think you should be able to get what I'm saying intuitively. About 5-10 years ago now in the UK, there was a divorce case. And the divorce case, let me start what the nature of the couple. This is a couple who met in Second Life. Okay?
Second Life. What's that? It's old school, Steve, for them. Second Life is old school.
Okay, well look, this is a kind of simulated world, okay, where basically you can invent characters to interact with each other virtually.
Okay.
And you can create these virtual societies, right? And actually these virtual societies take on kind of a life of their own, where they have their own currency, they have all, you know, so it becomes a kind of alternative kind of society. And people will spend an enormous amount of time online doing this kind of thing. It still exists, by the way. It's not like it's so. I mean, I tell you, how many of you heard of Second Life? Okay, thank you. So this is the idea, we're talking about avatars, okay? Okay, you know what avatars are, all right. Well, in a sense, this is the game, you know, that in the 90s invented this kind of avatar thing. This couple met online and they got married and then they lived together physically, okay? So what happens? What happens is the wife, right, as she is playing Second Life, sees that her husband's avatar is having an affair with an avatar in Second Life all the time. And of course, because most of their relationship was defined by this online existence, right? So you have to imagine that these people, the primary mode of interaction is not physical mode of interaction, but is in fact this virtual form of interaction, right, through the medium of the Second Life world. Okay? And so in a way, that's the quality time, right? And so we talk about quality time and where you, you know, where is it that you actually invest your meaning, your interest, right? This is where they're doing it. And so the fact that she finds her husband, her husband's avatar, literally, having an affair, okay, with another avatar in Second Life, she files for divorce. The punchline is she wins. She wins. And this gives you a sense of how the world's changing, okay? Because he didn't have any sex with anyone in a kind of physical, literal way. In fact, he might not even know who the physical person is behind the avatar. Might not even know that, right? But because the quality time, right, what was meaningful about the relationship to begin with, the terms under which they met, and the way in which they conducted their relationship subsequently, was happening primarily in this virtual reality of cyberspace. And so that then becomes the legal reality. That then becomes the legal reality, and then you are liable for the consequences of what happens there, because that is no longer a game. That is, in fact, your life. So even though there was no physical contact, that doesn't matter. It has to do with the where you're meaningfully spending your time. And so to me, this is a very important step in the direction of redefining what the person is under which one can have political or legal regimes, right? Because it's no longer exclusively about the parameters of your body, but rather it has to do with the way in which time is spent in a meaningful fashion by something that is in some sense regarded as an extension of yourself, of your physical body. Okay? And there's going to be increasing cases of this kind around. And the point that I would, you know, put on the table to you guys is it's going to make politics very difficult to actually organize. Okay? Because if you've got a large segment of the population who, in a sense, feel that they're the most important things that they are doing, I'll give you an example. Let me give you an example. One of the things that we're seeing now with the younger generation, your generation, is higher rates of obesity, and various kind of morbid health symptoms that people of my generation thought were going to be eliminated. And why is that? Because you guys are couch potatoes, basically, right? You're sitting around, you're not exercising, right? And so those, you know, people of my generation, we were very much, we are very much active people doing lots of stuff, but most of you guys are spending all your time staring at your computer screens or your smartphones. And so you're becoming these obese pigs, eating junk food, all the rest of it. Now, is this a problem? Right? Is this a problem? Of course it's a problem from the standpoint of people of my generation, where in a sense we were imagining this kind of progressive world in which a lot of these kinds of diseases of the heart, you know, heart disease, things of that kind that are connected to diet, would be remedied over time as people ate better. But of course, what you're seeing now among the younger generation is just people eating whatever crap is around because what they don't really care that much about their bodies anymore, because their bodies are just platforms for actually dealing with the virtual reality. Now, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but only a little bit. Because it is striking. Why do we have these rises in morbidity, you know, with heart disease and obesity and things of that kind? Why? Why is this happening now among the supposedly most educated, you know, people who've ever existed? You have an answer?
Yeah.
What's the answer?
I guess things got a bit easier.
Things got easier, yes, that's true, but also I would say that a lot of people are quite happy to kind of make this as a lifestyle choice because what matters to them is not how their physical body is, because they're just thinking about their physical body as a platform for doing this other stuff, right? So in other words, you know, they just, you know, in a way their bodies are just being fed or satisfied because where the real reality is as far as they're concerned is the stuff happening online. That's where the real action is for them. And as long as they can carry on that way, they're not worried about their, they don't care what their bodies look like. Okay? I mean, I think that's a bit, and I would put that to you because what I think here is we're getting into a kind of value shift, right? Namely, what is it, you know, how do you define the person? And so with the upwing, downwing thing, the way this would work would be the downwingers would be the people who think this, in a way, it's kind of an enormous mistake. We need to realize, you know, so in other words, we cannot just be these kind of easy living, endless consumers of stuff who turn into fat pigs, etc., because that actually is going to destroy the planet, it's going to make us live less, and so forth. Okay, and a lot of the environmental movement, if you think about what the environmental movement in terms of the ethics that are implied in it, the environmental movement, to a large extent, is very much an austerity movement. Right? Whatever you want to say about the environmental movement, it is an austerity movement. It is about recycling. It's about using less resources. It's about taking up less space. It's about having fewer children. Okay? That's downwinging. The upwinging approach is to say, the sky's the limit. Right? If we trash the planet, we've got Alpha Centauri to go to. Right? We'll float around forever. And if we don't float around forever in our physical bodies, we'll figure out ways of either, you know, going into deep freeze and resurrecting ourselves, or we'll just all upload our consciousness to machines that can sort of endlessly proliferate. Right? That's the upwinging approach. And what I would argue, I'll get to your point in a moment, is that that is going to be the new definition of politics. Right? The people who, in a sense, on the one hand, are very concerned about the fact that we're trashing our physical being, okay? And the others who say, big deal, I'll just turn into something else. Okay? So there is this, in the upwinging movement, there is this term, and this is, as it were, the notion of freedom and liberty for the 21st century. It's called morphological freedom. Morphological freedom. The freedom to be whatever form you want to be in. Right? So you can be physical, you could be virtual, you could be anything, and maybe you can go back and forth between them. You upload your consciousness into a machine, and then it gets downloaded somewhere else, right? And that this, for the upwingers, is the ultimate form of freedom to go for. Yes, sir, you had your hand up.
Yes, uploading consciousness and one of those forms include putting a brain in a robot body after you die.
Exactly.
Or a containment case.
Yes, exactly, yes. That is part of it, yes. The thing about morphological freedom is you got a lot of options, right? That's the point. You got this kind of lot of options. So you could upload into a robot, you could upload into all kinds of, or you could just put yourself into a kind of deep freeze, either in the literal sense of cryonics, or in a kind of simulated sense, right? Where in a sense, all your digital data, you know, so you, one of the things that there are people working on these days is to create what's called brain emulations, which is to say a digital record of what it is that's in your brain. And then that can just be stored and then uploaded into some being at some point in the future, whatever. Okay? This is something people are working on now. What this would do in principle is to give you a wide level of morphological freedom where you can choose how you want to be, and you would have rights and maybe even obligations that are associated with that. And that is very much part of the upwinging approach. So in other words, we are not restricted to our physical bodies as classically understood in modern politics, but rather we have this open opportunity. And the point I want to make about the downwingers is that downwingers are very skeptical of this. The downwingers believe that at the end of the day, we are in some very profound sense stuck in our bodies. Right? That we just cannot, you know, turn into everything we feel like turning into. But that we are in some way stuck. And this is where the environmental movement, I think, becomes very salient. Right? Because the environmental movement is very much about saying, look, at the end of the day, we're talking about using up resources, material resources, and kind of making people accountable for that fact. So for example, let's say you were able to digitally upload your mind into a computer, into a robot, whatever. At the moment, computers and robots and things of that kind use up more energy than actually the brain does to do the same thing. So whereas computers, of course, in some sense can outperform humans in various kinds of tasks, like, you know, chess matches and all kinds of stuff, I'm not denying that. Computers are very powerful things, but the punchline that you don't get is that it costs a lot of energy to do that.
They're more finite than us.
Well, yes, in a sense, the brain is, this is what makes the brain a kind of fascinating, you know, entity, because the brain is kind of the most energy efficient thing from the standpoint of what we normally consider interesting with regard to thought. Right, so at the end of the day, ideally, you don't actually, if you're really an energy conscious person, you really don't want everything to migrate from carbon to silicon, but rather to figure more carefully how carbon works and why it's as efficient as it is. And then maybe expand the brain's capacity. You see what I'm saying? Right, so of course, in a way, working on computers and robots is kind of easier, given the way our science has gone so far, but it's also committing us to larger and larger energy resources. Okay? And so this is a kind of interesting question, I think, from the standpoint of, you know, in this regard, environmentalism, I know a lot of you who are very tech-oriented people think of environmentalism as kind of backward, regressive, reactionary, etc., and I often share this view myself. But nevertheless, when you look at the energy usage of the brain as an entity for doing things, it is incredibly efficient. And that if we actually go back to those organic sources and understand them more carefully, and maybe enhance them, okay, that we actually might be able to make, you know, better use of the energy that's available to us in a finite world. Okay, if we operate on the assumption that we do live in a finite world. And what I'm saying is the downwingers definitely believe we live in a finite world, but the upwingers, in principle, believe the sky's the limit, right? That we can just keep on uploading and moving and expanding forever. I will stop here to take general questions, okay? Because I think there's a sense in which there's enough kind of on the table here, and what I would like to do is to get your reactions, just, you know, whatever you want to raise. We've got about 10 minutes, I take it? Yeah. Yes, sir.
Are you supposed to be a supporter of the upwinger claims?
I am an upwinger. Yes, I am. But I think the business about the brain that I was talking about at the end here is a very interesting point. All right. In other words, the more that I have come to understand, because, you know, there is this general trend to think that computers are going to replace brains in some way, and that we just need a powerful enough computer and it'll eventually outperform the brain and everything. I don't deny that that could happen. Okay. But my point to you would be, if it did happen, it would take up enormously much more energy than the brain does at the moment. Right? So you'd be committing yourself to an enormous amount of energy use in order to realize this kind of dream of the computer outperforming the brain. And that's where I think there's still a fair a fair battle with the biology going on.
So, as for me, Doppelganger, like if that thing actually happens, there are going to be a lot of problems.
Oh yeah, I didn't touch all the problems at all. No, what problems do you have in mind?
Casteism, terrorists won't die. Everybody will be.
Terrorists won't die.
And ideas will get killed. What if Newton's mind was formatted and made one like one of the English landlords?
Yeah, well, no, but look, I mean, one of the things that is, I mean, there's an interesting book, let me raise, and this is a guy you should actually invite, because he's in state of Virginia. I don't know if I've told you about him. Robin Hanson, I don't know, okay, Robin Hanson is an economist at George Mason University. He published a book earlier this year called The Age of M's. I have a review of this book coming out. It's a very interesting book. Okay, so it's M's. Now, what M's mean is brain emulation. So what he's imagining, so there are a lot of, here's the thing, right? When we think about the future and we think about all these wonderful futures coming on board, right? If you're an economist thinking about this issue, one of the things that you realize, just understanding the way in which history of the economy works, is that there may be a lot of different possible futures out there. But the first one to actually get through the finish line, where it's actually there, can end up crowding out the others, right? There's this thing in economics called path dependency, right? Where the first version of an innovation ends up dominating the entire market. And so what he's arguing in this book is that before we come up with any advanced brain science that understands how the brain really works, or we come up with artificial intelligence, we will be able to actually emulate brains. Let's say just copy brains and put them into machines. So we can copy, and so who will have access to that, right? This is the interesting question. And so what he's imagining is that in a way, in this upwinging agenda, the first thing that's most likely to happen is that we will be able to emulate brains, but they will be the brains of the people who have funded the research into the emulation, right? And so it might be Newton. I don't think it'll be Newton, right? But it might be some billionaire's brain. You see what I mean? I mean, in other words, it might be... whose brains will end up then being uploaded into computers and then being allowed to proliferate copies. And Hanson's argument is that this may end up determining the governance structure of the future if we're operating in a free market environment. Right? In a free market environment. Because all of these innovations that I've been alluding to in this talk, right, operate on the assumption that people are doing all this science, they're producing all these kinds of results, all these innovations, and that we have a relatively free market. So whichever one gets to the finish line first, which is able to actually reproduce itself, it will win. And nothing's going to really stop it. And so he's imagining a world where this could happen, where the brain emulations of certain select people end up providing the new governance structure of society. Okay? That's what he's saying. In the kind of world we live in, because in a sense we're sort of sleepwalking into this future. We really do not have good government policies with regard to how we deal with all these possible ways in which we could be upwinging ourselves. We really don't. They just happen, right? And most of them are happening in the private sector. And so the question is, what happens when one of them really works? Right? It can end up determining the future of everybody. Right? And so, you know, even though he is a free market economist himself, Robin Hanson, nevertheless, if you read his book, it's a kind of cautionary tale in the sense that he's suggesting, well, you know, governments, even though this stuff may sound very science fictional, governments now should be paying attention to this. They should be planning for this right now, even though the likelihood of this kind of brain emulation technology coming on stream may be a generation away. We should be planning for it now, because by the time it happens, it may be too late. I mean, I take that's kind of in the spirit of your question, right? Or did I misunderstand you? I think that...
No, like, I get your point, but my only point is that, given that, I don't think these problems can be solved anyhow.
Oh, well, then what do we do, Guy? You're going to be living through most of it.
What
do you do? Come on, you're going to be let's operate on the assumption you're going to live longer than me, right? That your diet is not such crap that you're going to be dying before me, but...
So we stop a lot, we ban that kind of research?
Well, this is where the government needs to have something smart to say about this, right? It shouldn't be just a matter of let 1,000 flowers bloom or ban everything, right? One needs to have a sort of smarter government policy that does, that in a sense takes up the middle, right? What is the nature of the kind of regulation you want of these kinds of new technologies? This is something that needs to actually be discussed now. But banning, obviously banning is not the solution. This is the point. Banning is, and why is it not the solution? Because if we ban it in America, it'll happen in China anyway. Right? So banning never works. Banning never works. What you have to do is have smart regulation. And what smart regulation means is not so obvious, especially when people aren't already thinking about these matters and they just keep on saying it's science fiction. It's not science fiction. People are putting an enormous amount of money trying to do this shit, okay? And so the point is it's gonna happen at some point, like it or not. And so the question is whether governments and policymakers are prepared to deal with the consequences when they happen. And this is where your generation has a political responsibility, because you're gonna be living through all this. Other issues? Sir, you seem to be on the verge of saying, you got your hand halfway up.
I lost it, sorry.
No, okay, but let me know. Other people, come on. Come on, you've got to have something to say about this. Yes, sir.
How do you feel that religion will play into the upwind versus downwind?
Well, see, the thing is, you got religion on both sides. This is the point I would make. The first point to make is that, I'll give you an example, right? I was talking to Jim about this last night. The upwinging stuff, you may be familiar with the term transhumanism. Transhumanism is kind of what the upwinging movement is. Among the people who are very much into this kind of transhumanism stuff are the Mormons, okay? Because the Mormons believe in the physical resurrection of the body, right? They believe, so in other words, they believe that the story of Jesus' rise from the dead is a literal story, and that this is something that is available to all human beings. Okay? And this is why the Mormon Church, you know, Brigham Young University being the kind of great kind of standard bearer for this in the United States, has been among the most consistently large-scale private investors in biomedical research in the 20th and 21st centuries. Because they are actually trying to do this. Okay? So in terms of this upwinging thing, they have no problem with that. Okay, and I don't think there, I mean, a lot depends on how, you know, we talk about biblical literalism, right? And that's usually used as a disparaging term because we're sort of always thinking about, oh, the world created in 6 days, that's bullshit, nobody believes that, right? But what about the biblical literalism that says that you can be resurrected, the body can be resurrected, which is also biblical literalism, that Jesus' body is resurrected. Transhumanism is all about that. Alcor, cryonics, it's all about that. And so there's a lot of religious people who are on top of this, okay? Not every religious person will be against this at all. In fact, you're going to see a split within Christianity on this matter, and not only Christianity, by the way, Islam as well. So I was mentioning Iran earlier as being this kind of advanced Muslim country. Iran is one of the strongest countries with regard to embryonic stem cell research, and a lot of these kinds of very progressive kind of biomedical innovations. Why is that? Because in Islam, the human body is regarded as a vessel for God. In other words, the body is not regarded as just a thing unto itself, but as something that God delivers himself into, in which case then you want the best vessel possible. And so that then opens up the door to an enormous amount of experimentation, potentially, with regard to the physical body. That's Islam, okay? I'm not saying every Muslim interprets the Quran that way, but in Iran they do, and that's why Iran has very advanced research in this area. Okay? Yeah.
When it comes to the concept of religion and politics, they sound like a good idea to combine them to some, but when you come down to it, bring those two things together when it comes to mainly when it comes to government and religion can spell out disaster.
Yeah, sure, but the whole world, I mean, disaster is inevitable. I mean, there's a sense in which, in other words, there's no such thing as living in a safe world, okay? If you're going to do anything interesting in this world, there's going to be risks. There are always going to be issues and problems. The whole history of science is full of this kind of stuff. So so the point here is that I don't think this is a problem unique to religion and politics. I think if you're going to do anything that's bold and daring moving forward, that you will have disaster. I mean, you know, and you have to live with it, and you have to deal with it, and you have to make people accountable for it, but you cannot avoid it. That's my point. You cannot avoid disaster. You really can't.
Let us thank Professor for I'll see you on Wednesday. If you